In Jesus' name, amen. I know it might be hard to believe, but I actually have training as a lifeguard. I know that's kind of funny to think because I'm not really like, I don't look like lifeguard material, but I do remember serving at Arrowhead Lutheran Camp years ago. They needed a lifeguard. I didn't have the training for it, but I did have the merit badge from Boy Scouts. So I think that qualified me to do that. One of the things that amazed me about stuff we learn, especially in lifeguarding, is if you are approaching a drowning person, one of the things you have to be careful about is to be pulled under by them. So oftentimes we're taught, you know, wait until they're like almost exhausted to the point that they start to sink. Because if you get entangled with someone who is drowning and is desperate, they will use you as a flotation device, even if that kills you. In fact, we were taught, and we actually had to practice that, where we would swim up to someone and they would get on top of us, and we had to learn how to swim down. We would actually be pulling ourselves further and further down, because if the further we went down, soon the drowning person was like, wait a second, this is the wrong direction. They will give up, and then you swim behind them, and then hopefully again they're tired. Because the idea is, you can't save that person if you yourself are dead. Right? That's kind of an important lesson. Jesus is not a lifeguard. That's not how he designed the salvation plan for you and me that was established before the beginning of the world, before Adam and Eve took a bite of an apple, before the world was plunged into sin. Jesus had a plan. And the plan was we were going to be desperate and we were going to be hurting and we were going to want to do everything we can to save ourselves. And as he approaches us, he actually ends up dying for us. It seems counterintuitive because, you know, shouldn't you be alive in order to save? But that wasn't Jesus. We have all been ingrained in us this ability to save ourselves. I was tempted to put some videos on, but they're just really hard to watch because it's people in fight or flight situations, and it's very embarrassing. Where, like, all of a sudden an earthquake starts happening, and the guy in the thing runs and leaves his two toddlers and his wife behind, right? That's because it's ingrained in us. Like, and I thought, oh, those are kind of funny, but it's like, actually, they're not very funny because that's really kind of sad. But that's all of us. We have this thing in us that if we need to do something to save ourselves, we'll do it. But Jesus ends up going completely counterintuitive to everything that's within us and says, the way I have to save you is I have to die. And it's interesting, some of the words that are used in this particular section. Jesus has now been convicted of treason. He was convicted in the Sanhedrin of blasphemy, but that charge wouldn't stick. So before Pilate, he's claiming to be a king, and enough pressure was put upon him. Pilate took the expedient route and not the good route and let Barabbas go free. We had thought to ourselves, I wonder if Barabbas ever walked out of town and seeing three crosses that were, and that middle one was supposed to be his. I don't know if he ever actually went back and looked. But in there, we also saw the fact that Jesus would be willing to die on our behalf. And so now comes the very painful time of execution. This would be the most heinous form of punishment that was ever created. It is torturous in all possible ways. And Jesus willingly, deliberately, chooses that path for us. Verse 16. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. Some people believe that it could be upwards of 600 guys, and which again is really painful to think. We all have these images of mobs, and imagine a mob of 600 very well-endowed, strong soldiers surrounding one person who is being sent off to his death, and essentially they were given free rein to, like, well, do whatever you want. And so, unfortunately, I don't know how many people eventually got their licks in. I don't know how many people eventually hit him or spit on him or kicked him. But you got to imagine a scene of one person in the middle surrounded by 600 people. It's hard to imagine. They put a purple robe on him, which I just put into my Bible because I'm really curious. Where did that come from? I mean, some guy had to have brought it. And what's going to be interesting is what actually happens to the robe afterwards. It's interesting when you start thinking about it. So some guy has a robe. They're going to go off this idea that he is the king. And so they twist together a crown of thorns and they set it on him. Again, Peter, as he's dictating to Mark, gives us details but moves quickly on and doesn't even allow us a chance to understand what's happening. The wounds that are going to be inflicted on Jesus are some of the worst in the world. Years ago, I was trying to do some stuff to my motorcycle, and I wanted to put this little fancy little red sticker on the wheel. I know it sounds dumb, doesn't it? But I thought this would be kind of fun. And so I had the bike out, and my father-in-law was helping me. He was there. He had his trailer out. Back then, it was the full motorhome. You know, the slides are out and everything. And so I'm holding the bike, and as I'm kind of moving it forward, and I'm getting the thing, and it's going on really good. And I get to the end, and I'm so excited. I just stand up in full force, and I hit the slide out, which is out, and go straight up, and it hits me right on the head. And part of me wishes it was like a sharper edge, because a dull edge, wow, that hurt. And immediately I was stunned, and immediately I feel this big, gigantic hand come down on me. It's my father-in-law. And he's like, hold still. And I'm like, what's wrong? He goes, you don't want to know. I figured out what happened really quick, because all of a sudden stuff is coming down my head, and it's getting into my eyes, and it's getting into my ears, and it's getting on my clothes. I, like, full force split open my head. I was unaware of just how much blood is in your head. It's the another Boy Scout rule, right? If your feet are cold, you put a hat on. You lose the majority of your heat out of your head. So if you put a hat on, it keeps your body warm. Yeah, I had blood pouring everywhere. And that injury is nothing, absolutely nothing like what Jesus experienced. These thorns would have been massive, probably about that big. And I don't think they gently laid it on his head, like, oh, here you go, sir, here's it. Oh, it's like really sticky. No, they got it on, and we know from other gospel writers that say they took staves and then they beat it down onto his head, so it really kind of drove it in. And it's painful. And Jesus, I don't know, is he struggling right now with fight or flight? If he is, it sure doesn't seem like it. He is. Like right then, he could have called down legions of angels to absolutely destroy those 600 guys. It wouldn't even have needed to be Michael the Archangel. It could have just been one, like, peon angel, because these people can take care of business pretty effectively. But Jesus doesn't appear to be in fight or flight, because he has a goal and a mission. I need to die to save you and to save me. So the crown of thorns is put on his head, and the purple robe is put on him. And again, this is going to be painful. His whole back is already destroyed, right? He's been through whippings and beatings. Probably his sides are all destroyed. And so then they put a purple robe on him. And as the blood starts to coagulate on that robe, what happens then when they're getting ready to rip it off? It's going to be really painful. I get a cut on my thumb and, you know, it hurts really bad. But it doesn't hurt anywhere near what Jesus is experiencing. Verse 18, and they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews." It's interesting, some of the things that are said and how true they actually are. Again and again, they struck him on the head with the staff, where the crown of thorns is, driving it deeper and deeper. They spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. So it's now not just physical pain, but he's being mocked. He's being made fun of. And if you've ever been in a situation where you're being made fun of, what do you want to do? You want to get out. You want to run. You don't like what people are saying, so you exit so that you don't have to hear people's ridicule of you. I'm wondering if Jesus' fight or flight instinct is there, and it is. I don't see it. He doesn't immediately stand up and say, "Actually, yes, I am the King of the Jews. I am the King of this nation. I am King of this entire world. I'm King of the universe, everything in it." And if he would have done that, he would have saved himself. But he didn't. He did not take care of himself because he knew he had to die to save you. And when they mocked him, they took off the purple robe, which would have caused all of his wounds to reopen, and now he's bleeding even more. And they put his own clothes on him, and they let him out to crucify him. Another person ends up coming into focus. We don't know a lot about him. It's always fun to speculate. These are the times when you say, "Gosh, was it this? Was it this? Was it this?" We get this man. He's from Cyrene. His name is Simon. And it's a strange thing that he says, "This is Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus." Simon who? What's his last name? Or better yet, what is his, Simon, son of, who's his dad? And Rufus and Alexander, who's Rufus and Alexander? But the people writing this, Mark and Peter, they seem to, be able to say, "You all know who this person is." So somehow or other, we extrapolate from that Simon of Cyrene eventually became a follower of Jesus. Now, we don't know, was he already a follower of Jesus prior to this? Or did this instance radically change his life? Well, this man is there. He was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. You would usually be carrying your own cross beam. I know some films show Jesus carrying the full cross. Probably not, as they've shown some of the stuff that's there, that the post in the ground is already erected out there, and then they're going to just lift him up and hang him on that with the crossbeam. It's one or the other, but whatever it is, Jesus is now probably entering into hypovolemic shock, which that's just a fancy word of he's losing a lot of blood. His head is probably still bleeding. Everything got ripped new again, so now he has to carry this heavy crossbeam, and as he's going, he's stumbling, he's scraping up his knees. He falls down on the ground. The crossbeam probably smashes the crown of thorns even further deeper into his head. He is now becoming as weak as you can get. And it becomes very clear Jesus is so weak he can't even continue on. He's stuck. At any moment, he could have summoned strength from his father. He could have endowed himself with supernatural strength, tapping in and flexing that God strength, but he doesn't. He's not going to do it. He could. He would save himself. It would be great, but he doesn't, because he knows he needs to sacrifice himself for us. So This guy, Simon of Cyrene, is forced to carry the cross. Verse 22, they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. If I were speaking Latin, it would be called Calvaria, which also means skull. It's always fun. Why did they call it the place of the skull? Some people say maybe the outcropping looked like a skull. I think the easiest one is that it does. Yeah, yeah. You see the face. I think the simpler one, though, is that's where everyone's dying. And, yeah, this is the place where the execution is happening. He's on the way out of town because it's great to be able to show people, you know, if you decide to try anything that is being done like these guys, the same fate will happen to you. And so there they are, place of the skull. Verse 23, then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. I know there's it seems that it's offered a couple of times, but at the initial thing, this would be, as best as they can tell it, I read some that didn't believe that, but it seems the most logical. This would be a narcotic, this wine mixed with myrrh, and it was designed so that you could like deaden the senses a little bit. You don't have to feel everything quite as much. There were some that said, actually, their goal was to keep you alive a little bit longer. So if you're not in shock from all the pain, this will deaden it so then you can actually live a little bit longer. Because that was their whole goal. How can we inflict the most amount of pain and have it last for as long as we can possibly do it? Sometimes these people would be hung on the cross for days. We often truncate it because the only experience we have is what happened with Jesus. He died in a couple hours. But for a lot, they would be out there for days. And again, to help with that, we're going to drink some wine. Because, wow, the pain is overwhelming. Maybe it'd be good for Jesus to take some of that. As that overwhelming pain is overloading every sense. He could have found that slightly easier way to suffer. And he says, no. Not going to take it. I don't know if they were surprised by that. I don't know if they thought that was funny, but essentially refusing this was his way of, again, not entering into fight or flight, but experiencing everything that was going to happen in its full force. And I have a hard time with verse 24. It's, it's too quick for me. In four words, Mark and Peter sum up the goal of everything. And they crucified him. The pain that he would be feeling at this point is very difficult. He's now probably spasming in all of his muscles. Tendons are probably destroyed inside. His hands are probably in a permanently crooked position because that's just what's going to happen. He's experiencing an immense amount of pain. And now he's also, if you've heard me speak on this before, he's now in a perpetual state of inhalation. So he can breathe in. The problem is he can't breathe out. So as you are hung up there on the cross, your diaphragm is extended. And so if you want to breathe, then you would just, your feet, which are held up by a spike, which would hurt, you would push up so that you could breathe out, you could breathe in, you could relax, and you would do that for hours on end. I remember one time, well, many a times, have you ever gotten like a really bad splinter? I mean, you know, not the small ones, like the one that goes really deep into it. Like you grabbed a piece of wood and you raked your hand across it, and it's in there deep. Well, that's Jesus' back now. As he goes up and down on that beam, with his back already open, and he's feeling every ounce of pain. Right then, again, he could summon something, anything, that would help him not have to hurt so badly. But Jesus doesn't enter into fight or flight. He's on a mission. He is not going to lose you. He is going to save you by dying. And then after they crucify him, they divide up his clothes. They cast lots to see what each would get, which is a really sad and horrible tale. You pray that maybe some good came of that. I mean, it actually very well could have. Because again, my brain starts thinking of all the stuff that isn't in there, and I wonder, who won? As they're casting the lots, someone won and got Jesus' clothes. And there was something special about Jesus' clothes. Jesus' clothes had this incredible power, not because the thread was magic or some witch cast a spell. It was because it was connected to Jesus, even to the point where Jesus could be walking amongst a crowd of people, and someone who had been sick for 12 years says, all I need to do is just touch the hem, like the bottom part. I am going to squeeze through. I'm going to get down. And if I can just touch the hem of his robe, I will be healed. And it worked. I don't know. I'd like to think that whoever won got Jesus' robe, and soon some strange things started happening in his house. His sick mom got healed. His kids were no longer sneezing. When everyone else was coughing with the flu, they did not. I can't prove it, but it's kind of interesting to think that someone took Jesus' robe. Verse 25, it was the third hour when they crucified him. Third hour is 9 a.m. And as they crucify him, there's going to be others that are there. They wrote a notice on top, the King of the Jews. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, which in Latin would then be I-N-R-I. Helps us understand whenever you see a stained glass window that maybe has a thing above it. That's what it's there. Again, interesting. We thought about it last week. Can't prove it. It was Pilate that wrote it. Everyone objected to it, saying, hey, that's not fair. Don't call him that. Don't say that he was the King of the Jews. Say that he claimed to be King of the Jews. And Pilate said, what I wrote is what I wrote. And next to him are two robbers. That's all we have. It's their charge. We don't know anything about their names. We have some writings that may hint at their names, but I don't know if that's really important. But there's one on his right and one on his left. Again, I wonder if these two guys were a little bit shocked, because who were they supposed to see next to him? They're supposed to see Jesus Barabbas, you know? Jesus, son of the Father, was supposed to be there, and now there's this other guy. And we find out that they know each other. One of them seems to understand who this guy is. We don't know if the other one is as well. One of them comes to faith right then and there, because he clearly sees with his own eyes that Jesus is not saving himself. His fight or flight is not there. He is instead laying down his life for everyone else. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads. I don't know if anyone's got a different translation, shaking their heads. I don't know if KJV is which one is that? Is that wagging? Yeah, wagging their heads, because that's a little bit more, you know. It wasn't that they were walking by going, oh man, I'm so bummed that Jesus is dead. No, they were wagging their head. Have you ever had your mom wag her head at you? You knew you better shape up at that point, or else some bad stuff's about to happen. But that's what they're doing as they're walking by. They're wagging their heads. It's in direct fulfillment of Psalm 22, where those same words are used. And it's interesting. Listen to what they say. It's fascinating. I never really noticed it until this time around. Again, God's good that way. He said, so you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself. Because that's what you do. When you are in trouble, save yourself. When you are hurting, save yourself. If a bear is attacking, you don't need to outrun the bear. You need to outrun the person that's with you, and the bear will get them. And if that's what happens, that's okay. Of course, then I hear people say, at that point, you know, the person starts praying, and they're like, what are you praying for? Well, I'm praying that the bear will be saved, right, and not eat us because we're Christians. And so the bear still comes, and all of a sudden, right before the bear's about to pounce, the bear stops, looks at him, and says, bless us, O Lord, for this meal that I am about to eat. I had to throw a little levity in there. This is tough. This is tough stuff. No, even George doesn't like it. Dang, man. Save yourself. And then listen to this, 31. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him. He saved others, but he can't save himself. So close, right? So close to the truth. I think it's fascinating that what do they admit? He saved others. Like, I had never really noticed that. They are actually admitting that this Jesus has power. They admit that he saved others. And again, that word saved has a lot of connotations to it. It could be used only in a healing way, but it also has this more holistic healing of physical self and healing of your spiritual self. They're actually admitting Jesus saves. Fascinating. And I wonder what is in their heart that is so horrible that it is preventing them from seeing this power for just as it is. This person is someone special. It isn't lost on everyone, because we do know that from another gospel writer, there was at least one centurion who, after his death, said, surely this man is the Son of God. And I don't know if that was because he looked up at a man who was hanging on a cross and seeing that he was not willing to come down. He was not willing to save himself, because it wasn't that he can't, it's that he won't. Jesus saves others, but he won't save himself. That's a little bit more accurate. And as he's hanging on the cross, breathing, going up and down, all of these people are mocking him. We wonder where others are at. We know that mom's around. We know that John's around. We wonder if Lazarus is there, looking upon Jesus, saying, this man saved my life and raised me from the dead, but he won't save himself. Or if that lady who had that bleeding for 12 years and was healed by touching the hem of Jesus' garment, I wonder if she was there. He saved me. He healed me. But he won't save himself. Or the person that was paralyzed, lowered down through the roof by his friends, was he there? Looking up saying, I couldn't even walk, and he saved me. And he didn't just save me by bringing life back into my legs, he healed me by forgiving me all of my sins. I'm now no longer just saved here physically, but I am fully saved. He saved me. But he won't save himself. That's because Jesus isn't a lifeguard, intent on saving his own life and then saving yours. Instead, he won't save himself. And they continue to mock him because this is something that he could have done. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come now from the cross that we may see and believe. Now, you want to talk about a temptation. Oh, man, if I were Jesus, I would immediately, like, dissolve through stuff. My body would be fully healed. I would get up really high up in the air floating. I'd have muscles. I'd have abs. It would be amazing. And I would have stuff shooting through my eyeballs. And I'd be like, I am off the cross. And question, would they have believed? No, I don't know if they would have believed. They'd have been like, oh, wow, he's demon possessed. Oh, wow, I think I might have dipped into that wine with myrrh a little bit too much. Oh, wow, it's a really hot day today. I think I need some water. Because for them, they don't need a Savior because they're going to save themselves. For them, they don't need someone to forgive them of their sins because they'll do it on their own. And there they had the opportunity, as they're even saying it, if he does this, I'll believe. He's already healed people. He's already healed the blind and the deaf. He's already healed Malchus's ear. He's already raised people from the dead, and that wasn't enough. He saves others, which I'd like to change it if that's okay. I think you know what I would like to change it to. Because others is, you know, yeah, he saved others. Do you want to know who he saved? Yeah, you know my answer. He saved me. He hung on the cross. He willingly gave his life. Not in a lifeguard way where he had to save himself, but instead he willingly died so that he could save Mark Manning. And I find that absolutely incredible. And I know that's weird because when I say things like that, I can't help but smile because I'm thankful for this man who sacrificed himself for me, yet he's hanging on a cross. But I'll never forget that he did that on his own. He was not forced or coerced. He didn't leave. He stayed for me. And he did it also for you. And you may be sitting there saying, well, I don't know. Do I really need saving? I don't know. Do I really need forgiving? I don't know. Do I really need help in this world? I don't know. Seems like a lot. And I just want you to just look at the cross and notice that he did that for you. And there was a time that he finally did come down from the cross as his lifeless body was removed and put into a tomb. Even then, I think it would have been fun to come back to life right then. As they're pulling my body off the cross, what a wonderful thing. But no, he dies and he's buried because in 3 days he will rise again. And that's when he saves himself, after we are already saved. Let's pray.